losing our way today.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place. We are finishing up a two-part conversation from the producer's desk, where the job is a little less about having all the answers and a little more about noticing where things don't quite line up. In part one, we asked the question, what does it look like to find our way well? So what does it mean to step out into the world of ideas, psychology, social sciences, disciplines that weren't formed explicitly from scripture and still remain grounded? In this second part, we'll turn that question right around, because the risk isn't just out there. It's what happens when we come back and start letting some of those tools reshape the very foundation we started from. Sometimes what we learn from the world doesn't just inform our thinking, but can set the terms for how we read, interpret, and even prioritize scripture itself. So how is it that we lose our way?
So as Daisy just clarified for you, what we discussed on the other side of this topic, we referred to as finding our way, by which I mean finding a path on which we can hold all of the tenets of our faith, along with all the practices that are implied by it, but also use the things that help us that we gained from the experience of life. So how do we hold the tenets of our faith and the useful things that we learned from the experience of life? Which means that we take the experience of life as a, you know, in this case, a supplement to the elements of our faith, not a rebuttal to our faith, not a competition with faith. And you can listen to the other episode to get the details of this. But the alternative to that would be artificial. And there are, and I'm being critical of that approach now, not so much to, you know, try to attack someone who holds that view, but to say to us that we should be aware of the inconsistency that taking that view would imply for us. So if we were to take the alternative approach, you know, let's all our experiences in life, the phenomena that we actually encounter in our daily lives, those are rebuttal of our faith. They would be in competition with our faith. So we reject them. I reject the plain experiences of my life in favor of my faith. Taking that position would pitch against each other the idea of faith and lived experience. In the world God created for me to live in the world with the phenomena to which God exposes us, that dichotomy, and I'm not pretending that in our fallenness we couldn't corrupt all of that phenomena or any of that, but that dichotomy, the way of looking at the world as if we have to choose between living in it or having a faith that the whole world is my enemy. And if you say, oh, but the Bible talks about the world as the indication of what's fallen and the temptation that comes from the world and all those kinds of things, we have to be more precise in our language than that. And I'm not going to do all the theology or biblical studies that go along with that right now, but we would definitely not want to say, oh, anytime you use the word world, you're talking about wickedness in toto. Because God loves the world. I know he loves the world so much that he gave his son to die for it. And he died for it because it is corrupt. But it's not the same thing as equating the world with temptation or equating the experiences that we have in that world with evil. It's not the same thing. So anyway, regardless, I know most of us know that. But my point is, if we do hold a dichotomy like that, well, I've got my faith on one side, and then I've got that world over there on the other side, then religion becomes, it can become any of these things. It's certainly that dichotomy what allows religion to become a basis for terrorism, for instance, because that kind of faith can blind us to what our empathy, which is a real world phenomenon, otherwise would demand of us. Religion could be allowed in that dichotomy to become an excuse for withdrawal, because that kind of faith sees everything outside its control as the enemy, rather than the means of its ongoing work in us, of faith's ongoing work in us, or the object of faith's ongoing demands on us. Oh, you encountered poverty. You need to do something about that. You encountered hypocrisy in your own life. Oh, you need to do something about that. We don't just see experience as something to be neglected because we're so pure in our faith. But finding our way to peace with the lessons of experience, and therefore with what comes out of experience, which is science, which is where we spent a lot of our time talking last time, that also finding our way toward that peace also creates an opportunity for us to lose our way along that very same path. And that's the point of the conversation today. It's it has to do with this pragmatic shift, this way of seeing the world differently, more pragmatically, that comes with the disciplines of science. I love science. I love everything scientists do. I just am not a scientist, so I can't pretend that I'm know enough about any of this to do science, but man, do we learn a lot from science, and am I grateful for what science is able to provide us? Does that mean I agree with every conclusion that every scientist draws? Obviously not, and that would be part of my point today, that we don't have to lose our way just because we find a way to say, look what science provided for us. I love air conditioning. Therefore, I can't believe in God. I don't have to do that. I can love the science, and I can also hold on to my faith. They're not inherently incompatible. But there are differences that we still have to recognize, and if we don't, we can lose our way. But on both sides, scientists can lose their way if they think that the two are so distinct that they could never be connected, you could never have both at all, or so blended that they're identical in what they do. Either way would lead to a kind of error. Not in this episode, but in another episode a long time ago, I talked about some of the philosophy of science issues that come about when we recognize that there has to be some kind of relationship between science and religion. It can be an exclusive relationship where they're in opposition to each other, but we gave four different options in that one. In this one, I'm just saying somewhere between saying they are completely in competition with each other and opposed to each other, and saying, well, really, they're the same thing. It's just different ways of expressing exactly the same truth. Somewhere between there is where I think we need to think about this issue, and that somewhere in between there, whether they are horizons for each other or just compatible with each other or complementary with an E to each other, however we would take it, that somewhere in between is probably where we need to land. That's a big part of the point today. But it's not just philosophy of science. It's to use science as this primary home base of where we are pragmatic for discussing how we can respect science and still hold on to our faith. Okay, so that pragmatic shift behind the disciplines of science puts us in a position where there is a risk that we could lose our way as we begin to gain more and more confidence in pragmatism and even let it shape, as Daisy was saying at the end of her introduction, Daisy's our producer, that we would let it completely reshape even the way we ask questions about faith. So that pragmatic shift is nowhere more obvious or evident in at least American history than in the educational enterprise, how we think about education in general. And it's primarily in the person of John Dewey and all of the schools that come out of his way of thinking of education that change takes place for us. Now, worldwide, it takes place in some other contexts, Marxist context and stuff like that. But here, it's John Dewey's pragmatism. And what his pragmatism did, and you know, I mean, I know pragmatism's not just in him. I know C.S. Pierce and William James and all that. But in the terms of education, it's John Dewey's influence that's primary. And it is a conversion of education from this way of thinking of passing along information from one generation to the next, which is still true about education. No matter what you do with it, you're doing that one way or another. But you know what I mean. He converts that into problem solving. And that, you know, we have adopted this view so much. What I'm about to say is just so, it's so commonsensical. It's so prima facie to us. It's going to sound like, how could you even disagree with that? Which is going to be part of my point for the conversation today. But he converts that into problem solving, meaning we no longer see the teacher simply as and this is the way a lot of people word it, the teacher as an oracle. I have all knowledge. Now sit and I shall fill you with my wisdom. And now we pour the wisdom of the teacher or the professor in higher education into the poor, ignorant, empty student who now is filled with that same knowledge and able to pour it into their students as well. That's the more traditional model. I have all of the classical information you need. I will now pour it into you and you will have it. And even people who follow in the vein of Dewey's more pragmatic understanding of education as an experience of real life problems and a way for a student to become a problem solver, even people who adopt that in their practice in some ways, a lot of ways in their own mind are still thinking of themselves just using slightly more sophisticated techniques for conveying information from one generation to the next. Dewey's point is a lot more significant than that. It is not, you just need information from me. It is, you need to learn what it means to be a problem solver from me. And it doesn't matter which information you have or don't have. You can get that anywhere. What matters is that you learn the means of problem solving by actually being exposed to problems and then working with someone who has more experience in doing it. It's more like a mentor, you know. So it's critical thinking also instead of just rote memorization in this model of problem solving. But you can hear it's very pragmatic. We have real world problems and we need to solve them so our students are successful to the extent that they can solve a problem, not to the extent that they can rehearse a multiplication table. That's not good enough. They may need to memorize a multiplication table, but it's because if they can multiply numbers, they can then figure out how to solve this problem with AI that's developing or whatever. So by the way, there's plenty of evidence of the influence of this kind of pragmatism in the education world. It's a shift in the whole way we do educational administration. I'm in higher ed, the president of Criswell College. I've been a professor for 26 years now, teaching philosophy and history and stuff like that in different contexts and ethics, all that. And I love doing all of that stuff. I love teaching it. But the whole model of education and the way we measure the success of education, which is a lot of what educational administration is about, is that it, you know, educational administration isn't just show up, fill out the forms, attend the meetings, make sure that everybody's passing down the knowledge that needs to be passed down. But instead, it becomes a way of setting student learning outcomes. And those outcomes aren't just about, like I said, rehearsing multiplication tables as the example, but it's not just about students learning facts. It's more about students gaining the skills to solve new problems. So problem solvers, we want, I mean, even here at Criswell College, one of our defined outcomes is for our graduates to be problem solvers who think critically, creatively, and collaboratively. There is built into that the things we want there, the objective content of critical thinking, but there's also the creativity and collaborative nature that goes more with the pragmatic. Well, the collaborative part is being peacemakers. We want them to work with other people. But the creative part is also part of being a problem solver in a new world. You're going to face problems that others haven't faced, and we want you to be able to think creatively, outside the box, come up with your own solutions, and so on. It's a part of that pragmatic world. It's fine. I don't have any problem with that at all. I'm not saying we exclude the nature of scientism or pragmatism from what we do as people who hold faith. I am saying that we don't let it define completely what we do. So we haven't lost our way yet in the journey. I just want to point out this is how influential pragmatism has become. It's become a basic definition of how you do things in our society. Pragmatism is the American philosophy, as we often say. So the shift happens in our society, this pragmatic shift happens because it's for a good reason, because the scientific method proves so much more effective at addressing empirical realities than just darkroom rationalizations. You know what I mean? But if you put your hands on things and test ideas out, you get better results than if you're just sitting in a room with a pen and a piece of paper and saying, how could I solve this? Well, let's try this. Well, let me think about that. You can think about it 100 times and still come to an incorrect solution, which is proven by the fact that when you try it, it just doesn't work. And you can say, no, it works. It just didn't work in the real world. And we're going to go, that means it didn't work. You don't understand what the basic goal was here. That's the shift. The pragmatic shift says it's only true, it's only right, it's only good if it actually produces the result that you want. And again, that's so commonsensical to us now, we can't even hear where there could be a flaw in that. That's part of what I'm trying to get across by saying how influential this is. And science is that good at doing things. And again, science is not the only way that we're pragmatic, but it is the most rigorous way that we are pragmatic. And just as an example, the law of uniform acceleration. This is from Galileo. Those of you who know science know this is elementary school science that I'm talking here. It's very simple. But, you know, the whole idea here of a law of uniform acceleration and what that implies about falling objects. Now, all of us can join in the conversation at this point and go, oh, yeah, well, of course, when Galileo, you know, this is the caricature of it, stands on the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa and drops a grape and a watermelon. I don't know what he dropped, and I'm quite certain he wasn't standing on the Tower of Pisa. Actually, it has nothing to do with that. He used an inclined plane to do the experiment. But the point is, in the way we talk about it historically, you know, we kind of jokingly say, so he's standing up there and he drops these two objects and they hit at the same time and voila, that we got to think about the world differently. We never thought about the world this way before. That's because, you know, the pure theory, the close your eyes and think really hard about it in an ancient world, Greek world, where Aristotle was trying to define laws for us about motion. And Aristotle wasn't against putting your hands on things, but, you know, this is the ancient world, and you think about things teleologically. And again, other episodes to get to that word, we don't have time today. The point is that you're thinking about things more in a, let's think really hard about what this would have to mean and the way it ought to be, if the world is the way it should be, if it's measuring up to its potential, whatever. And the idea in Aristotelian thought about falling objects is that the speed of a falling object is directly proportional to its weight. And, you know, if you do an experiment with a watermelon and a feather, it works out that way. You know, it makes sense. But experiments aren't the point here. It seems obvious that a heavier object is going to fall faster. And if you think about it really hard, it makes sense that you would say rationally, that's the necessity. And there, but what contrasts with that is practical observation. It just doesn't prove out to be true. And that doesn't start with Galileo at all. I'm, you know, by 500 AD, I don't know when before that, and I don't remember the guy's name, but by 500 AD or so, there's a Christian, you know, philosopher, thinker, scientist, they're all the same thing then, but who, you know, observes that that's just patently not true. Because when I drop a couple of objects and one of them is 10 times heavier than the other, the one that's 10 times heavier doesn't hit 10 times faster than the one that's 10 times lighter. Anybody can see that. It doesn't matter what. If I'm dropping the water bottle lid that's across the table from me and the bowl that's across the table from me, the lid is 10 times lighter at least than the bowl. And they're not going to hit at exactly the same moment, because I'm not really good at dropping things at exactly the same moment. But they're close enough that I know it's not 10 times slower. So come on, something's wrong with Aristotle's theory. Observation had made people question that theory 1,000 years before Galileo. But Galileo observes it with such detail and then finally creates this formula that all of us know, that the velocity of this object under acceleration is derived by, you know, it's 1/2 at squared. I mean, that's the formula everybody knows. you know, half of the rate of acceleration times the amount of time squared, right? So that's the formula for, a constant acceleration, uniform acceleration. That's what it's called, the law of uniform acceleration. Galileo gives us that, so he gets credit for observing this. None of that ever reaches the light of day or a piece of paper if we're not actually making observations in the real world. And for 1,000 years, not 1,000, but close, 800 years from Aristotle to the first observations of anybody who at least put it down on paper, and then it's observed after the Christian by Muslims in the Islamic world also. They begin seeing it in the Arab-speaking world. And then Galileo and contemporaries are all observing this. That's just not accurate. All of those are happening because of experience in the real world. And I don't think, let me explain how clear this is. Not only did it take hundreds of years, but let me just give you one that I don't think any of us would get right today if I said this. I'm not going to ask Daisy because it's not her job to be my guinea pig in the studio. But I do, I don't think there's a single pure theoretician in the world who, before they already studied this. Now, anybody who's done physics or anything, you already know this because you've been taught it. But without having done the experimental stuff that proved this was true. In fact, if I drew this up for you, what I'm about to describe, on a piece of paper and said to you, this is what's going to happen, you would not believe me until I actually got the objects and showed you in a room that it was going to be true. And I bet in a minute Daisy's going to be looking at me in a way that I can say, yep, sure enough, she does not believe it at this point. But this is the absolute, I do not think any pure theoretician in the world could have predicted the way Bernoulli's principle affects a ball in a funnel. I just don't think anybody would figure it out without having actually done the experiment. Now, I don't doubt that somebody created the experiment because they thought, that implies that this would happen. And that doesn't make any sense. I'm going to have to try that. And then they tried it and they went, oh, sure enough, it works. And now it's the coolest Bernoulli's principle experiment in the world. Maybe there are cooler ones, but this is the coolest one I know. What am I talking about? If you take a funnel, you know, a funnel like you use in your kitchen to pour from a large mouthed something into a smaller mouthed something else. How's that for precise language? A funnel, you know, goes down like and then has a narrow. OK, so you get a funnel like you would use in your kitchen or for pouring oil into your car. You get a funnel like that. Don't do the one that you use for oil, though, because you're going to put your mouth on it in a minute. If you get a funnel like this, or you can just look at this up on the internet and you can see it. This experiment is very common and popular, and people use it to show how crazy this idea in physics is. If you put a ping pong ball or something light in that funnel, it's in the so you're holding the funnel upright, right? And then you hold the funnel upright and you hold your head up so that you can blow into the bottom of the funnel, up on the funnel, and blow the ping pong ball out of the funnel, right? It's obvious. You're going to blow on the funnel. It's going to blow the ping pong ball out of the funnel. Never happen. It will never happen. Daisy is slightly confused. Not confused. She's inquisitive. I can see that on her face. Okay, so here's the thing. Not only is that true, if you hold the ping pong ball in the funnel, turn it upside down, put your mouth on the funnel, and start blowing, you can hold the ball in the funnel by blowing upside down into the funnel so that the ball is trapped by what? The wider end of the funnel? It doesn't make any sense. The ball should be blown out of the funnel by your mouth. All of our internal theory tells us that's what should happen. There's pressure underneath the ball. It's going to push the ball out of the funnel. It should, and upside down, it should just fall out on its own, much less with the pressure that's coming. But the pressure from your blowing the air actually creates the Bernoulli principle, where if there's higher speed, there's lower pressure. And because the ball in the funnel has a smaller space for the ball at the base of the funnel, not at the top of the funnel, then the air has to move faster to go around the ball, creates less pressure, and the air at the bottom, if you're holding it upside down, the air above the ball, if you're holding it right side up, it's moving less fast because it has more space to move around. And so it creates greater pressure and holds the ball in place. It's basic Bernoulli principle. It's why airplanes fly. I'll even ask Daisy to create a link to some video online that shows that. You'll find one. The point is, you would never guess that without experimentation. It's the nature of the world. My point is, we cannot pretend like observing things in the world doesn't teach us something we didn't know before. And I have looked, and I cannot find a Bible verse that says you should be able to blow a ping pong ball out of a funnel. There's just not one. And so I don't think it compromises our faith for our experience to shape the way we think about the world, in addition to our faith shaping the way we think about the world. That doesn't mean they're never in competition with each other. It never means that you have an experience that might make you think wrong about your faith. That I'm not saying that, because we can also think wrongly about our experiences. So what are we supposed to do with it? So here's the problem that we run into. We dealt last time on finding our way with trying to address the question, well, how do we hold both of those together? That was finding our way. Today, it's losing our way. Where do we go wrong when we try to put those two things together? And this is where we go wrong. And it's on the natural tendency of pragmatism to expand its domain. And here I'm going to shift the word from pragmatism to induction. This is not a wrong thing about pragmatism or induction. It's just something we have to be aware of. And then a natural tendency we have because of how well inductive reasoning, which is at the core of pragmatism or empiricism, it's how inductive reasoning works, we would have a tendency to extend the value of inductive reasoning or of pragmatism beyond where it's actually valuable. So here's why that happens. Empirical sciences, you know, you observe things and then draw conclusions and then you know, and so on. Empirical sciences are inherently inductive. If you're not familiar with the word inductive, I'm not going to give a big lesson on it today, but in a basic sense, it means we learn by observing. So you can see how that's all tied together with empiricism and science and pragmatism. We learn by observing. In inductive reasoning, you observe a thing over and over again, and then you finally draw a general conclusion about it. That's inductive reasoning. So here's the thing about empirical sciences being inductive. And by the way, induction is way more prevalent than just in the sciences. All the things we say we know about our lived world are inductively derived. But science makes the point best because it's so rigorous in its inductive approach. So when a science, you know, and science using this inductive method, they're using the scientific method. So when a scientist first hypothesizes, she's already way down the road of induction. So say I'm not the she scientist, I'm just me. I'm not a scientist. See, I told you, I'm not a scientist. So this is a different illustration. Say I hypothesize that the moon is wobbling. This is called libration, by the way. Libration, if you haven't heard the term before. So the moon's wobbling as it faces the Earth. And if you're not familiar with that, the moon is tidally locked. Tidally locked means the same side of the moon always faces us. By the way, in light of the glorious Artemis mission, as I'm recording this, it's not finished yet. Still lots of dangers ahead, but I'm quite certain they'll complete it successfully because they're just so good at what they do. So as I'm recording this, on the assumption that it is successfully completed and all things go well, and it is, they have been to the other side already. There's been a lot of confusion about the language, about the dark side and the far side of the moon and all that kind of stuff. Those are two completely different things. We get to see the dark side of the moon because shadows fall on it. I'm saying it, Daisy, it's not complicated. Shadows fall on it, so it's dark. That's not the far side of the moon. The far side of the moon is lit as often as the near side of the moon. The far side is the side we don't see because it's away from us. But it's not quite that there's just 50% of the moon we see and 50% of the moon we don't see because the moon's wobbling all the time. So it's tidally locked to us because somehow or another it's not equally gravitationally dense. You know, something is keeping one side facing us all the time. So that's just kind of how it works. But it's also not on a string. So it's wobbling around up there. And if you watch the moon for a month, day to day, and take pictures of it, like I do sometimes, then, you know, you get to see the wobble. Oh, look at that. It's moving a little up and down, a little side to side. And it's just kind of like a ball out there floating that's not stable, not quite stable. That's kind of how it looks all the time. So that's how you would do it. I would hypothesize the moon is wobbling, and then I would, you know, take a picture of the moon even in as often as I could over that month from the same place at the same time. And then notice that sometimes a crater is a little further from the limb than it is at other times and so on. So the point is I would test it out and see if it showed up over time. So when this scientist has to test her hypothesis, she conducts an experiment. So she takes images of the moon using the same method, the same location, the same timing, every day for an extended period. And she's able to create a time-lapse video showing the wobble. And then, based on her experience seeing other things in time-lapse and other things that wobble, she confirms her hypothesis that the moon must wobble. It's a really important hypothesis. Maybe not that important to you, but it's really cool. Anyway, so what now happens when she makes this claim in public? I have observed that the moon wobbles, she says. Some people believe it, right? Why do some people believe it? Because they are also drawing an inductive conclusion. Why? I've heard other scientists claim things in the past, and those things turned out to be true, so I believe her. Or they've heard things from scientists in the past which turned out to be false, so they don't believe her. There are a few people who are like that, right? We've heard a few of those lately, but of course, that doesn't make her claim false, so they conduct their own experiment. So let's say they do their own experiment, and lo and behold, now they verified. Lo and behold, the moon does wobble. Now, why do they believe the results? Because they've learned by experience that if the same thing happens over and over again, you can reasonably, within bounds, assume that it's going to keep on happening. And that's the way you generalize a rule about it. So in this case, they can generalize that, I think the moon does wobble. But they might also, this is what most of us have done over time, they might also generalize that perhaps not all scientists are liars and falsifiers, you know, that some things scientists say may turn out to be true, as it turns out. So all that's going on here is that science is just using the most rigorous form of the induction that all of us rely on every single day. And because of that underlying induction, and I mean this in a couple of different ways, I'll explain in a second. Because of that underlying induction, science also does something else, which is it. So this is what science does that we know. Science relies on induction to arrive at its conclusions, which is why its conclusions are so practically effective, because you try them out over and over again, and you don't draw a conclusion until you've seen that they work, right? So obviously they're going to work. So it's almost theoretically absurd to contrast that, but it's also almost theoretically absurd to believe some of the things that science claims that we do recognize we're willing to believe. Some of us are still a little like holding out on some of these things, like quantum computing. Are they really going to be able to do that? You know, create a quantum computer where basically you're getting the answer before you ask the question? That just doesn't make sense. And yet, in the laboratory, people are doing it. They're doing the things that we would expect from quantum computing. And because of that, I'm forced. I'm sitting here going, man, that doesn't make any sense. But, I mean, science knows what. I mean, they've done so many experiments with it. There are so many evidences here. It's really hard to read the data any other way. And so induction just sort of makes me say something I wouldn't want to say otherwise. That's important, that science relies on induction to arrive at its conclusions so effectively that it's very difficult to prove science wrong on something. It's not impossible, because sometimes we draw a conclusion without enough evidence yet. And so, I mean, science is not flawless. It's not inerrant. It's not that. But it is something that powerfully influences the way we think about the world, because it so effectively uses inductive reasoning, right? But as this is the other half of what's going on. As science demonstrates that prowess, which obviously this, what I'm about to say, would be undermined as science makes mistakes. And science has made plenty of mistakes, so it's not like they never err. But as science demonstrates more and more of its prowess, because with all the mistakes science made, planes are still flying. You know, some things have fundamentally changed in the way we interact with the world because of the technologies that have been developed by science. I had people in my more conservative background question whether either relativity or quantum physics could actually be true, and that it wasn't just some kind of giant conspiracy of this or that. I said, well, you know, I mean, the bomb blew up, so there's a lot of evidence that something's really going on at the subatomic level there. So, you know, science has that kind of power. As science demonstrates more and more prowess like that, more and more effectiveness in one study or one experiment or one problem after another, then induction as a method also practically compels us to apply its method to the other problems that we've not yet solved. That's the natural, that's the way induction works, right? Hey, I saw, oh, look, science solved that problem. Ooh, look, science solved that problem. Ooh, look, science solved that problem. I've got a problem over here. I wonder what I should do. What should I do? Well, induction just begs me to say, let's try science. Let's see if it solves that problem too. You see how induction sort of inherently expands its domain as it is effectively used as a tool. And induction wouldn't see the boundary, well, first of all, because it's a method of reasoning and not a person, right? So it'd be hard for it to see anything. But you get, I'm personifying it. Induction doesn't see the boundary to applying its conclusions to the next discipline, whatever it is. So when the next discipline is just a branch of physics, fine, nobody questions that. When the next discipline is sociology, pretty much fine. Eh, there are some complications because trying to account for all the variables in a softer science like sociology makes for repeating, for instance, hypothetical text challenging, to say the least. So here, I want to do an experiment. How do I repeat that experiment? Well, I'll do the best I can, but I mean, there are going to be some variables we can't control in a social context. Like, for instance, we're already in a different place in history, if nothing else. I'm in a different place in history at the end of this sentence than I was at the beginning of the sentence. There's no way to get out of that problem. So in a softer science, you inherently run into some barriers, but you can apply it to some things in sociology, and so you begin to realize, yeah, we can make sociology a science. It'll be a social science of types, like we talked about last time. When the next discipline then, after sociology or something like that, is psychology, then most of us are okay with thinking of it in some way scientifically, but and there are certainly some rigorous, scientifically rigorous methods that can be applied to psychology, and if nothing else, I'm thinking of behaviorism. If you're doing behaviorism, you can be very rigorously scientific about it. You can measure behaviors. You can see what the actual responses to actual stimuli are. And except for the extraneous stimuli that you're not able to measure at a given moment, you can control the variables about as well as you can in any experiment. So you can do it to some level, but there are even more deeply seated complications than there are in something like sociology. One of them, the privacy of consciousness. So how do you feel when I say that? Well, I don't know how accurately you're defining how you feel, nor do I know how precisely the way you use words to describe how you feel relate to the way I understand the words you're using to describe the way you feel. You get how impossible it would be to get inside of that. And then the one that goes along with sociology, the impossibility of exacting control of all the variables that are there, adding to the fact that you're in a different part of history generally, you're in a different part of your personal history, your personal consciousness is isolated from me. And those are just the most obvious barriers that we have. Those are limitations, though. They're not barriers to using the scientific method at all, but we recognize there's a limitation. In areas like those, it makes sense for a vigorous debate to rise up and for people to say, well, to this extent, we should use the scientific method to solve psychological problems, but to this extent, we're going to have to rely on more humanistic means, or we're going to have to rely on more liberal arts means, or we're going to have to rely on more religious means, or, you know, whatever. So you have a debate about that, and you figure it out, but you don't just say it's one way or the other in those cases. I get that. But this question of how far we can extend induction goes beyond the questions of how far we can extend science or the scientific method. It goes more generally to the nature of pragmatism, which is also a product of inductive reasoning. So if we define, and we do, we define everything as a problem in our society, in American society, then the only way you can see describing the good result that you want would be to see a solution. If we define everything as a problem, then solutions are the only valid way of addressing the problem. And again, that sounds so commonsensical, so prima facie, that it's hard to imagine what's even wrong with the statement, right? We define everything as a problem, then we only see solutions as valid ways of addressing it. Well, yeah. what's wrong with that? What's wrong with it isn't the problem-solving method. In some areas of life, what's wrong with it is seeing everything that's happening as a problem that we're supposed to solve, as a problem that we can understand even and address. But that is the nature of human comprehension, human modernity, optimism, meliorism, progress. Those terms that I just threw out, those are all the defining characteristics of the contemporary world. It's what sets apart the pattern for how we live from how the world was before the Enlightenment. We are absolutely committed to this. And so therefore, even those of us who know better, and I'm saying I know better, I hope I know better, but I fall prey to the same thing. Even those of us who know better still fall prey to it. We avoid, for instance, pragmatism to determine the shape of a ministry. Oh, what I'm doing here is spiritual. I want to follow Christ, trying to be a good disciple, trying to help other people be good disciples. I'm not going to define this by pragmatism. I'm not going to define it by what the world would define as success. I'm going to follow Christ, and whatever the cost is the cost. And we're just going to do it. We do all of that. Okay, so here I'm defining my ministry. So we avoid pragmatism, for in my example, to determine the shape of what a ministry should be. But then you know what we do? We argue that our decision turned out to be right because of how well that ministry is going. Oh, and look, I made this hard decision to do the right thing, and it proved to be right because it worked. That's how committed we are to pragmatism. And if you didn't hear the hypocrisy in that sentence that I just uttered, my hypocrisy in the sentence that I just uttered, then I would encourage you to go back 15 seconds and listen again, and then again and again and again, until you can go, oh, yeah, that doesn't make sense. I'm going to do what's right no matter the cost. And lo and behold, what I did turn out to be right because it worked. There's a serious problem in that way of thinking in this domain, what I'm talking about right now, which is specifically ministry and Christianity. That's the world that I live in. So in Christianity, again, specifically in this world, Christ is Lord because he's God. He's creator. It's testified by the resurrection. Whether anybody accepts it or not makes it none truer or falser. It's just what it is. And yet, you know how I constantly hear Christianity's validity given to it? By the expansion of the truth of its message through the world to be the largest religion in the world. And look at what happened. Those 12 became multitudes who became multitudes who became the most dominant religion in the world, which is what we are now. I just want you to think about this for a second. In reality, the least convincing evidence of Christianity's truth is that it is the largest religion in a world as corrupt and mutually destructive as this one still is. That's not what tells us Christianity is true. It's success, the fact that it turned out to work. The measure of Christianity's truth is that Jesus rose from the dead. That's it. We believe it, we don't believe it, it's still absolutely true. Now, I can say that, and it sounds nice and simple, and, oh, we just need to make sure and protect the purity of our faith from the corruption of falling into the inductive method. And that is the sentence I want to get across. That's the absolute truth. But let me clarify how I mean that. And this is going to take more than just a couple of minutes. So I'm going to go just a tiny bit long today. It's not a whole other episode, but maybe an extra 10 minutes at most. This is the whole point. We don't need to discard the empirical or the inductive in order to maintain our grip on the eternal. But we do have to reconsider its primacy and its limitations. Its primacy, you know, like, that's the most important thing. Did it work or not? We have to decide that. And we have to recognize where the limitations are. So the scientific method, along with all of its empiricism and inductive reasoning, has proven itself indispensable, invaluable as a tool for addressing all kinds of matters of fact, the phenomena of daily lived experience, even the weird encounters we have with material reality. Empiricism works tremendously well for addressing those things, including science and the inductive reasoning that goes with it, and pragmatism. Love it. And for all the material phenomena that we face, it's a powerful tool for cutting through all the biases and oversights and myopias and the tenacity of our sometimes errant beliefs that we have. In other words, when we start applying the inductive method, we actually can use the inductive method to test ourselves and make sure that we're being honest. And it works really well. I think the world is this way. Oh, yeah? Well, let's just do an experiment and see if that's true or not. Oh, maybe I am prejudicial in this case, you know, whatever. It can be fantastic for that kind of stuff. However, here's the challenge that we have. And this comes from Sir Arthur Eddington. I'm actually going to give you the actual quote. I've referred to it many times in the past with an approximation. But here's the actual statement, and this will take just a couple of extra minutes. Sir Arthur Eddington on the philosophy of physical science. And what he's observing is that induction, the scientific method, this whole empirical pragmatic thing that I'm talking about, it's going to have a tendency to claim more authority than it should and to reach further than it should. And for us to think about the world in a way that requires us to be able to have a pragmatic evidence that what we're doing is worthwhile, for it to be worthwhile, and yet that's an overreach of what pragmatism ought to be able to do. Here's how he says it. Let us suppose that an ichthyologist, you know, a person who studies fish, right, or things in the ocean like that. Let us suppose that an ichthyologist is exploring the life of the ocean. He casts a net into the water and brings up a fishy selection. Surveying his catch, he arrives at two generalizations. Number one, no sea creature is less than 2 inches long. Number two, all sea creatures have gills. In applying this analogy, the catch stands for the body of knowledge which constitutes, I'm quoting Eddington, which constitutes physical science, and the net for the sensory and the intellectual equipment which we use in obtaining it. The casting of the net corresponds to observation, for knowledge which has not been or could not be obtained by observation is not admitted into the physical sciences. You see, we're talking about empirical science. An onlooker may object that the first generalization is wrong. There are plenty of sea creatures less than 2 inches long. Only your net's not adapted to catch them. The ichthyologist dismisses this objection contemptuously. Anything uncatchable by my net is ipso facto outside the scope of ichthyological knowledge and is not part of the kingdom of fishes, which has been defined as the theme of ichthyological knowledge. In short, what my net can't catch isn't fish. And so he goes on describing the things that come out of that. And what we do is the same thing. We start saying, if something doesn't solve a problem, if something's not, it doesn't follow the rules of pragmatism, if it doesn't in some way address this problem that I've defined as the thing that is what my life is about, if I can't define things in that problem-solving term, then we just say, well, that's not the thing we want to study. We only want to study these things that can be caught in this 2-inch net. And doing that leads to the same kind of error that reductionist sciences lead to. Reductionism in science is the idea not just that your science studies things in this way, but that if it can't be studied this way, it isn't a real science. So thinking of psychology, there are behaviorists who have said, well, there's no reason to study some internal mental concept or idea or use all that kind of therapy. Behavior is all that matters because it's the only thing that's real. If it's not behavioral and if it's not indicated behaviorally, why are you even pretending it's there? That's casting a net that has 2-inch holes and saying nothing smaller than 2 inches exists. The whole nature of especially the religious enterprise is that we can't reduce it to pragmatism. And so what we do if we fall victim to this, if we fall prey to this, is we reduce being a disciple of Christ to living a successful, I've got air quotes up, life. We reduce ministry to growing a following. If you don't have a following, what kind of leader can you be? I've heard that 1,000 times. If we reduce disciple making to how great a following we have chosen to submit the whole idea of ministry and truth and all the things that are associated with it to pragmatism, to this net that's got 2-inch holes in it, and we're starting to produce, and it's obvious that we're ignoring all the stuff that's smaller than that if you look at the things we're producing with our net with the 2-inch holes. And we'll reduce a vocation to wealth. It's no longer about whether we're actually being fulfilled. It's just about whether we're getting the wealth that would fulfill us or not. And I'm not against people making money. I'm not against using the money for good things. I'm not against that. I'm saying we can't reduce the sense of purpose that we have in life as followers of Christ to something that would be pragmatic. That would be the problem. And the long and short of it just comes down to this, that when we are committed to a foundational truth, there may be times when not solving a problem is not the worst thing that can happen. In my case, if I had to compromise the core of the message I believe Scripture teaches, which is what I think my life is supposed to be about, that, if I had to compromise the core of the message I believe Scripture teaches in order to maintain a ministry teaching about those Scriptures, well, I mean, that would be a Pyrrhic victory, right? I would have lost more than I gained in the process. That is, we have to find our way to accept that God teaches us in all kinds of ways, including science and all the kinds of experience through our lives that we have, often in ways that are unique to us, but we also don't want to lose our way. And I'm speaking to those who want to follow Jesus now, specifically, on the narrow path that few find, the one that leads not to solving one problem or another in this life, which is important, but quite in contrast, the one that leads to eternal life. May we find our way to the full path God gave us here and never lose our way on the narrow path that leads us home.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.